On this episode of Skeptico.
You can keep your iPhone and all that as long as you accept the fact that your dead relatives might be listening into your conversations and your iPhone might pop up with some weird message at any time because you might be getting some communications from angels or whatever. So that is a very different kind of science than we've come to accept. If anything, it's really more of a traditional, I think we'd call it like a magical worldview.
You know, that magic that you're talking about, it had never happened to me like this until these incidents started happening with Fari after he died. And for those who haven't read An Atheist in Heaven or don't know about it yet, the first incident I'm going to tell you about was really just the first that happened the week of that tribute. And there have been over 100 since then.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, you know, I guess to paraphrase an old saying, some of us go seeking after-death communications, others have after-death communication thrust upon us. I guess that would be the theme of today's show with our guest, Paul Davids, who's had an amazing string of after-death communication experiences with a longtime friend and work colleague who is this kind of Hollywood legend in the movie business, in the monster movie business, Fori Ackerman. So it's an interesting story. It's also interesting that Paul goes about trying to unravel this mystery by taking a very scientific approach, which many of us on Skeptico would feel comfortable with, but as you'll hear in this show, I also think has some limits in terms of how far we can take this. All in all, it was a super interesting chat with a fascinating guest. Here's my conversation with Paul Davids. Today we welcome filmmaker and author Paul Davids to Skeptico. Paul has some genuine Hollywood bona fides. I mean, some real legitimate Hollywood credentials for writing, producing, and directing, including a film that we're going to talk a lot about today, The Life After Death Project, in which he follows the trail of a series of after-death clues and communications left behind by his longtime friend and Hollywood sci-fi legend, Forrest Ackerman, who, and this is the interesting twist on it, Forrest Ackerman, who is famous for his Monster magazine that he edited for a long, long time, this guy's an atheist and very much of a non-believer in the afterlife, but seems to be, from what we learn in the film and in the other interviews I've seen with Paul, just a delightful guy and open-minded enough to promise to message back to his friends if he did reach the other side. So for the rest of this just remarkable story, let's welcome Paul Davids here to Skeptico. Paul, welcome and thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, Alex. It's a real privilege to be on your show. I see I'm in very good company, judging by former guests that you've had.
Well, you're padding the resume, let me tell you. Let's start by telling folks a little bit about your background. And in particular, what was going on in your life when these strange communications started coming through from a guy who was really a longtime close friend of yours, Forrest Ackerman?
Well, Alex, first, I'd just like to clarify something. You talked about the movie, The Life After Death Project, which I completed in 2013 and was on Sci-Fi. And, you know, it's out there now. It can be found anywhere. DVD, Amazon Prime. But the reason we're looking at this again now is that I've just finished a book that I co-authored with Gary Schwartz that came out in April called An Atheist in Heaven, The Ultimate Evidence for Life After Death. And that book, co-written with Dr. Gary Schwartz, went into much, much more depth in all of the events, phenomena, and issues that were raised in the Life After Death Project. So that's sort of to clarify. We're here because first there was this documentary film. Now there's this new book, An Atheist in Heaven.
Awesome. And I appreciate you clarifying that. That's great. And also what's hanging out there that I saw that I wasn't able quite to pin down is the Life After Death Project Part 2, if you will.
Oh, that's a good question.
What's that all about?
for those who get the DVD of Life After Death Project, it's a two DVD set. The first show, which is about an hour and 40 minutes, was on Sci-Fi Channel. Part two was not. And part two, I put together a sequel because I had so much material, so many people I had interviewed, so many incredible incidents and facts that couldn't make it into the first one because it could go on forever and people don't appreciate necessarily two-hour movies. So I created a second one called Life After Death Project 2, Personal Encounters. And I bring in the paranormal incidents related to afterlife that are experiences by many, many different people in different walks of life. So you sort of walk down the lane there and hear that so many people have had these experiences. They have similarities. They also have differences. And I included an update on the Forrest J. Ackerman case. By the way, we called Forrest J. Ackerman Farry. Everybody called him Farry. And let's call him Farry today when we're talking about him.
Fair enough. I'll let you lead with that. So great. Thanks for updating me on this book, An Atheist in Heaven. And I think the material that I've gathered is kind of similar, but it's interesting. Then tell us maybe the sequence of events leading up to this experience that you had with Forrest, and then if that was really what sent you on this path, kind of where you've been since then, which you kind of covered a little bit, but I'm kind of a little more interested in the backstory of what exactly was going on with you when you started having these communications with Forrest.
Well, I had known Forrest for decades. I met him when I was a 13-year-old boy. I was a fan of Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine. I love this man. He was one of the pioneers of science fiction. I think he was born in 1916, and he was one of the main promoters to bring science fiction into the mainstream, because early on it was off in the fringes. It was barely considered literature at all. It wasn't really respected. And today it's just taken over the world of entertainment, and there's so much science fiction literature out there. It's become very important. Farry was at the forefront of that, and he influenced just about every major personality who went forward to make a mark in the field, whether it's in writing or in making films. So Farry and I had known each other through the decades. I had written for him on occasion. He wrote a foreword for my first book, and as he got old, he was active into his 80s. He died at 92, but was always the atheist, as you mentioned. He was sort of a card-carrying atheist, if there is such a thing, and proud of it. And he would write about the reasons for his atheism and why he didn't believe in life after death. And he also didn't believe in any of the other phenomena. He could rule out ghosts and zombies and the undead and whatever it was, angels. Wasn't real for him. It was all fiction. And a lot of it was fiction he loved, that related to creatures, monsters, mummies coming back to life, all that kind of thing. So a couple years before he died, I wasn't the only one to sort of confront him. Others who were close to him did too and said, Farry, you're really strong on this thing that there's no afterlife and you're an atheist, What if you're wrong? Have you given any reconsideration to your ideas? And he said, no, I'm going to be an atheist to the day I die, to the day Prince Sirki takes me, which was the way he expressed it. But he said, but if it does turn out I'm wrong, and he said this sort of with humor, I said, if I wake up to some big science fiction convention in the sky, I'll be busy reuniting with all of my favorite horror and science fiction actors, and of course my dear wife Wendane. And he said, well, and when the party dies down, he says, if I can, maybe I'll drop you a line, let you know. He said, but don't count on it, not gonna happen. So that was the setup for it. He didn't believe in any of this stuff, and he died December 4th of 2008. And it took a couple months for a tribute to be held because he didn't want a funeral and he didn't want a memorial. But he told his closest caretaker, who had lived with him the last 10 years and helped him in every respect, a fellow named Joe Mo, a Hawaiian guy. He said, Joe, you know, a tribute would be fine. So a big tribute was held for him at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood. Every seat was filled, and there were many important speakers, including his friend Ray Bradbury, the great writer, John Landis, Guillermo del Toro. Peter Jackson checked in by video from New Zealand, and I was a speaker too. My credentials, in addition to the friendship, I had produced films in the genre. One of the best known is called Roswell for Showtime, about the flying saucer crash of 1947. And I wrote a number of the Star Wars books for Lucasfilm with my wife. We wrote six sequels, from The Glove of Darth Vader through Prophets of the Dark Side. So I was very much part of the whole science fiction world. Anyway, it was right, actually the weekend of his tribute, that the weird stuff started to happen. And it didn't start with me. It started with two Canadian filmmakers who had come down from Canada with their documentary they had made, a biography of Fari's life, which was shown at the tribute. I won't go into detail about what happened to them first, but they made it very clear to me and to others that after they visited his crypt, and one of them rapped on his crypt and said hello, that they felt that within an hour they heard from him in ways we would call instrumental transcommunication involving their computers.
The only thing I would interject is that among the various evidence that you compile and present, which is really pretty remarkable, especially the sum total of it, but the two Canadian filmmakers, I think, is really one of the hardest ones to shake. I mean, especially for anyone who's technically inclined, I love the part where the guy actually goes to post something on Facebook, and you know, the little, we're all familiar with the little captcha that comes up where you have to verify that you're a human and enter in something. And those we know are just these random collection of letters and numbers. And up on the screen pops Ackerman with a capital A, 000. I mean, this is like not to be believed. And yet it's verified by his colleague, who then has his own unexplainable
immediately. It happened immediately. A message came out of his computer, a voice, when they began to question whether Fari really dead. And a voice out of his computer said, "Oh my gosh, no way." And it was an animated emoticon that says that you can find on YouTube, but he wasn't logged onto YouTube and it wasn't in his hard drive. And as, Ian Johnston, he was the fellow who had that computer. As he said it, my computer had no business talking to me. So that kind of started things out. And for me, I know you're very interested in science, Alex, and you've got a book that says science is wrong about almost everything. And I don't know if I would agree with the almost everything part of it, but I do really agree that science has gotten so many things wrong in the past. Of course, science has tended to correct itself through the years. You know, we do have aviation. We can fly. It is possible. You know, rockets can go to the moon. All of these things, views have changed. You know, the Earth isn't flat. But science has gotten it wrong and enforced its beliefs, really enforced certain attitudes and philosophies and beliefs on whole populations of people, and put you in a position where you're ridiculed if you don't go along with the norm.
That's a really interesting point, Paul, because both in the film and in this book, An Atheist in Heaven, The Ultimate Evidence for Life After Death, and the book and the film cover a lot of the same territory. I know there's additional stuff in the book, and I've just kind of pulled that up here. And it's interesting. I look forward to going through that. But you touched on, for me, a really key point, because you do take a very scientifically inclined approach to this. I mean, Gary Schwartz is a highly respected scientist, folks, you know, and he's Harvard. He's the head of the department at Yale in psychology and psychiatry. I mean, he's science, publishing in peer-reviewed papers, currently a professor at University of Arizona. He's interviewed him a couple times on the show, as well as some of his colleagues. But here's the rub with that. You know, science is, on the one hand, so much a part of our life. We live in a scientific world, and we want scientific explanations for things. But on the other hand, and I think the movie and the book just touch on this, the life after death hypothesis that you lay out kind of renders science meaningless, in that once we step over and cross into that understanding that life continues, that consciousness continues, and that that consciousness, which is what the movie and the book is all about, has the ability to impact our physical reality here, then everything that science seems to know kind of gets very fuzzy. And yeah, you can keep your iPhone and all that, just as long as you accept the fact that your dead relatives might be listening into your conversations, and your iPhone might pop up with some weird message at any time because you might be getting some communications from angels or whatever. So that is a very different kind of science than we've come to accept. If anything, it's really more of a traditionally, I think we'd call it like a magical worldview, you know, where, hey, there are these competing forces and some of them look a lot like our reality here, but some of them are outside of that and we're balancing and mixing those. So have you given any thought to that, Paul? I mean,
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, two things I wanted to say about that, because you mentioned this sort of magical sense about what real reality may be. That magic that you're talking about, it had never happened to me like this until these incidents started happening with Fari after he died. And for those who haven't read An Atheist in Heaven or don't know about it yet, the first incident I'm going to tell you about was really just the first that happened the week of that tribute. And there have been over 100 since then. And they're all documented in the book. There's a glossary. There were simply a massive number of things that happened to me since 2009 that I either could not explain, in some cases, science could not explain, and because there was physical evidence that I was able to take to top scientists, and they really, really worked on it and really were baffled. And in one case, one of the scientists was, I think you have to say, sort of haunted after he began working on this, because the same kinds of strange things that had been happening to me happened to him. Now, but they don't happen all the time, and it sort of comes and goes. And when it's not happening, you know, your rational mind comes into play, and my skepticism, you know, it's always there at a certain level. I mean, you always have to look at whatever phenomena that you think is really important and say, wait a minute, am I interpreting it right? You know, did I really see what I thought I did? And usually the answer is, yes, you saw what you...
But usually doesn't really work in that sentence. I mean, that this is, I guess, the point I'm kind of driving home here, is that it really requires a fundamental worldview shift. And I think a lot of times what we all do is we want to have one foot in both worlds. We want to say, well, I took it to these scientists and they could explain some of it, but they couldn't explain all of it. That's not how science works. If science cannot explain it, if it's outside the realm of what could possibly be explained, and if the evidence piles up that it totally shatters the worldview, then you got to shift. But I think we all want to have a foot in both worlds. I mean, we like the comfort of the regularity of these things, but I wonder, to what extent has this changed you in terms of saying, you know, I can kind of play this reality game, but in my heart of hearts, I know that there's a dramatically different reality that I'm embedded in that I don't fully understand, but that I have to just kind of wade my way through.
Yeah, I've undergone a massive change because of this, Alex. I mean, the desire to reject it and continually look for other explanations. Gary Schwartz has a chapter about that in here. It's kind of a natural, ingrained human desire to question, you know, to question your own sanity when something happens that you really have always believed is just impossible. And that is what happened to me. So I have gone through this great shift where in one of the chapters late in the book, I explain, you know, I give up. I can't use my rational mind each time one of these things happens to try to maintain the same order in the universe that, you know, that I was always used to, you know, for my first 40 years or so. And the reasons are many. Well, I've been through 100 experiences of strange things of many different varieties. And let me just sort of rattle off the category list, you know, because it includes instrumental transcommunication, which is communication through instrumentality, which would be either computers, telephones, videotape, you know, recordings of various kinds. I've had experiences with mediums who have been vetted by Gary Schwartz, who studied mediums and tries to eliminate the wheat from the chaff. He eliminates the wannabes and those who think they have the ability or are just fooling themselves. And yet there are some who really, really do have the ability, unquestionably, definitely, regardless of what Michael Shermer tells you or the amazing Randy, they are wrong. Yes, there is a psychic ability, and it does sometimes manifest through mediumship. I've had synchronicities, so many of them that are so improbable one after the other that it's almost like being struck by lightning. It's that one in a billion chance that keeps happening and happening and happening that relates in some way specifically to Fauri, and you can't explain it. The other thing, category of phenomena, would be what I call the strictly physical phenomena. Again, you can't deny it. When an object moves in a house, in your own house, the doors have been locked. You went out for lunch, and it's not a question of a window being open and the wind blowing something across a room. No, objects will move around. They will disappear. A mask will pop off the wall in front of a lot of people at the punchline to a joke. A mask of Fauri's face, you know, moved across the room. So, I think the most important of all the physical phenomena for me was the one that started it all, and that had to do with chemistry and ink. And if there are chemists listening to your show today, Alex, I plead with every chemist who comes across this information to read An Atheist in Heaven. Because this will get to you. This will get under your skin and challenge the scientific worldview through strict orthodox approaches to forensic chemical analysis.
Well, hold on. Before you say that, because I appreciate that, and folks will find that in the book. But I think it's interesting you referenced Michael Shermer a couple times, and he's been on the show a couple times, and I don't know why we all keep talking to Michael Shermer, but we do. And that's kind of how our culture works and how we have these people in.
Well, Alex, you always need a chief adversary or boogeyman to measure your.
I suppose. I mean, you're the film director, so you know better the arc of the story and the different archetypes that have to play their different roles. But I do think it's interesting what he says in response to that. I mean, he's an interesting figure in a couple of ways. One, because I'm sure you know this, but he's had a very strange after-death communication experience, which on one hand, he's documented. And on the other hand, and this is what he says in your film, and I just saw in the introduction of your book, he's in there as well. He says, hey, and this is a bizarre statement. So let me just say it, but I'm going to try and deliver it at the straight face. He says, hey, you know, strange things do happen. These one-off things do happen, and we just have to not worry about them and kind of go on. And I think that this is a worldview issue. This is like a religious issue, and it's something that
he's so wrong.
Well, it's no more of a mistake than to touch on your other work of, you know, The Lost Years of Jesus. It's no more of a mistake than for a Christian to be kind of confronted with, you know, the historical facts that have been dug up or the Nag Hammadi Library and whatever, and say, you know, I can hear all that, but I choose to believe this, and I'm just going to ignore all that and continue to believe that. So my point is, I think we confront this all the time. And I think it's more of a worldview issue than it is a chemistry issue. Or Gary Schwartz, who's done an awesome job, you know, in the photons in the box communication and all that kind of stuff, that will appeal to some people. But at the end of the day, this isn't this really about worldview, about beliefs, about what makes us feel comfortable to sleep at night?
Yes. Psychologically, in terms of human consciousness, yes, it does. It does come down to that, because, look, one of the things Michael Shermer said about the life after death question, he said, look, I'm not against it. He said, you know, why should anybody be against there being an afterlife? Doesn't mean you necessarily believe in it just because you'd like it to be true. But for me, it is true now. And it wasn't throughout my whole life. It wasn't. I was one of those objective, rational materialists, you know, Princeton educated, science background, originally pre-med, you know, organic chemistry, all the rest of it. No, I had to be beaten down by life experience.
Right.
To come to the conclusion that there's much, much more going on here in this world we live in. And you don't have to say the universe, you can just say right here on Earth, than most people ever genuinely imagine.
Right, and I'm totally with you. I am very, very much the same, and a lot of beating down, like you said, a lot of beating down and continuing to be re-educated, and then rejecting and back and forth, and we've been through that process. What do you think about, let me just throw this on the table, what do you think about people who, and I'm always amazed by folks who do this, but there's many who just don't worry about that. They just have an experience or generally have an experience, but sometimes it's not even that profound of an experience, and just go, well, that's it. You know, angels are real. I have guiding guardian angels and they seem to work in my life. I have these synchronicities. They seem to work in my life. Hey, that's it. So from a worldview belief standpoint, we have to acknowledge that those folks are out there as well. And I don't know. I mean, I'd be interested in your opinion. Over the years, Paul, I've come to gain more respect for really where those people are coming from, because I see my position as not being all that different. I mean, I'm just compiling this information and chugging it through my, you know, rigorous, logical kind of thing. But at the end of the day, it's all just about how we're processing our life experience, isn't it?
It is. It really is. And I think that direct personal experience, which we can't predict, we can't make it happen. We might want it to happen. I mean, a lot of people would like to see a UFO, right? And they never have. One of those is Stanton Friedman, who's one of the world authorities on UFOs, and he's a physicist. He's never seen one. He believes in them totally and passionately.
Which to me is always more impressive.
Yeah. Well, he says, I've never seen a molecule either, but I know that molecules exist. I've never seen an atom. So the mind deduces things from what it sees around it and what the individual experiences. And all of our experiences are different. Now, for the person who is drowning and suddenly an angel appears and saves them, and then they're on the shore and their life has been saved and they saw the angel, well, who's going to question that? I mean, maybe some people will, but see, I believe it when I hear that from people. I've heard about angelic intervention. I never would have believed it for the first 40 years of my life or so. I just would have said, well, I'd have to see it. I'd have to experience it. And that's the unfortunate thing. I have experienced this now, and I've done everything I can to document everything that's happened. When I say I've experienced it, it's not, you know, something angelic necessarily. What I've experienced is that Fari Ackerman, who was a humorist, he was a prankster, and he knew me very well, and he liked me a lot. You know, he kept me around as a friend for decades. We had something together. And what I've come to understand is that his consciousness, his ability to interact with me, it's still here. it hasn't vanished because he's died, because he has done many physical things that relate to him very specifically. Often when I'm thinking about him or doing something that relates to him, these things will suddenly happen. And I'm always astonished. But I try to train myself now to be less astonished, you know, to just go with it, flow with it, accept it. It's real. It is real. And the mission I'm on is to help people who may have been where I was during those 40 years of doubt and disbelief.
Right.
To understand that it is real and why I think that it's completely logical to come to that conclusion now. The evidence is all around us. And in An Atheist in Heaven, my God, the book is 514 pages, including the glossary and index. Two authors, me and Gary Schwartz, each with our own sections of the book, and contributions from one of the top chemists who worked on the key mystery in the Fari Ackerman case. And I'm talking about Dr. John Allison, a chemist from New Jersey, a professor. The work that went into recording it all, documenting it all, I mean, why do it? We did it for science. We did it for the advancement of knowledge. You don't expect to make, you're going to grow rich off of something like this. But there was dedication and a feeling of the need to do it. And me, on my part, a sense of responsibility. And that was it. It came down to the fact that if Fari has survived, as he's making it obvious that he has, and he's going to all this trouble to continually remind me of that, and give me incidents that I can point to, talk about other people to, take into laboratories for scientists to struggle with and prove these things. If he's going to all that trouble, then my responsibility is and has been record it all, present it in the most coherent possible way. So first there was the movie, The Life After Death Project. And that was a logical way to start because things were happening in laboratories that I could film. People were making themselves available to me who I could interview, including the great author Richard Matheson. And then in the aftermath of that was the advice from academic people saying, look, you've got scientific reports, you've got studies, you've got the things that went on in those laboratories, and all of the details that are missing from your movie, it needs to be a book that we can, you know, hold in our lap, give us an index, give us a glossary, give us something we can study so we can really absorb the whole thing and take it seriously in an academic sense. So I really am spending a lot of energy to appeal to and draw the attention, I hope, of the skeptics, the scientific community, those who would normally just dismiss this. I'm saying, I want to open this door for you. I have the way. I have the way to show you because the way in through this door is through the logical mind, the scientific mind. We can get there to these conclusions through the scientific research. We've already gotten there.
I've been on that path myself for 8 years and followed it many of the same ways that you did, and am constantly hammering on the science as we know it, types, and you know, the people have written, the people who still write. You know, I just interviewed Sean Carroll, who, you know, unbelievably ridiculous with the nincompoopery that life is meaningless and none of this stuff is real and is completely ignorant about the research. And yet you look on Amazon and his book is a number one bestseller in science. So, I mean, we are not going to turn that ship, is kind of where I was kind of going with my last rant to you, is that it's a religious belief system. It's the same way as, you know, let's go out and convert religious people, be there Christian, Jewish, Islamic, whatever. Let's convert them. You know, I mean, you don't do that. It's just folly. I mean, you can do it, and there's plenty of people who do it, but we kind of realize that at another level, it's approaching people from the wrong way. And because one of the lessons we get out of this is we don't know what journey these other people are on. You know, you mentioned early on just a throwaway point that I think is key to this whole thing. And you say, hey, about Fori's comments to you that I'll drop you a line, but don't count on it. And you go, that was the setup. Well, who set that up? Who set that up? I mean, one of the things that we understand, as soon as we understand that consciousness extends beyond bodily death, and I agree with you, that is the biggest step for anyone to make. But that would suggest that this was set up, that there was some direction, some force beforehand that, again, we cannot really grasp or touch or understand, but the evidence of that is overwhelming, both the anecdotal evidence, and then if you want to break it down into science, I mean, some of the most well replicated and published research on presentiment suggests that our understanding of time, our experience of time, is not what we think it is, and that things, we do know things, and quote unquote, before they even happen. So, of course, we would have to throw on the table that Forey was playing out some drama in while he was alive, being the...
Well, and it was a drama larger than he could see himself at that time.
Completely. So here's my question. I rambled on for a long time. Here's my question. I think maybe we'll kind of head towards the home gate with this. But, you know, this is remarkable work, important work, and I love what you've brought to it. So where should it go? Where would you like to see, beyond an important distinction here, beyond the after-death communication is real, life extends, after consciousness survives bodily death, which I think you and I agree is the most important step for most people to take. But here's the question with regard to quote-unquote science. What would you like to see science do for the next step? Because we can go into Gary's lab and we can see the photon thing that says we can communicate. Mm-hmm. But I mean, what do we do with that? Do we ask what we should be doing here? What we should do with the planet? Do we ask what the message is? Should we go down that path? Or should we use it just to reflect on our own life and enhance our personal connection to other people, which is what all the mystics say. They say, forget about all the technology, forget about all the bells and whistles and the fireworks going off. Just love each other and try and find that connection in your daily life, and all the big stuff doesn't matter. What is your thought on the really, really big questions in terms of what do we do with this?
Well, I think it's a little of all the things that you've talked about. I'm not sure that let's all love one another is the final conclusion. It's a good and easy conclusion for...
It is the overwhelming message from the near-death experience science. And what I mm-hmm. think is interesting about the near-death experience science is everyone focuses on, did they see deceased relatives and did they cross over and how long was the resuscitation? Over and over again, if you read those accounts, and there's thousands of them, what they come back and say, it's about love. I experienced this higher being, and what they told me is it's about love. You got to talk to people who had the psychedelic experience. Overwhelmingly, it's about love. Mediums, their communication, overwhelmingly. I've talked to many of them, talked to some of the best researchers, including Julie Byshell, you know, former associate of Gary, and spoken to Gary many times. It's about love. It's about love. It's about love. So I'll just leave it.
Well, I'm not going to argue with love. You know, I've been married longer than George Burns and Gracie Allen were married. Very long. That's Hollywood great. Marriage. So I know about love, and I have a wonderful family. And I'm not going to argue about love because the Beatles taught me so much about it. And the name of that show in Las Vegas called Love was, you know, one of my favorite things. But I think there are other aspects to the point you were raising in terms of what we do with this, because I think there needs to be a changed attitude, more of an open door from science and scientists, so that there can be research, because science isn't going to progress without the research. There needs to be the possibility of grants and acceptance of the research at an academic level as something that's legitimate. Whereas right now we're living in a world where pretty much the door is slammed and someone's credibility is harmed if they get too deeply into this, or they're accused of delving into the occult and that offends many people's religions. Or they're ridiculed. They're made to be kooks. Society at large rejects rejects them because of their interests and I'm not even going to say their beliefs. It's the conclusions they've come to that there's merit to all of this and something real. If communication between the living and dead is a fact, and I think it is, I absolutely think that at least the deceased are communicating with us. I don't know how well we're doing at communicating with them. But if you're attentive in some cases, as happened with me, a deceased spirit, in this case a really great soul, can reach out to you. So we want to be able to reach back. We want to be able to have greater communication to increase our knowledge. So I say it's equally about knowledge as it is about love. It's equally about broadening our perspective of what is this universe we're living in all about? How does it function? How does it operate? Because we're only seeing a small picture of it. Alex, there's one other point that you raised that I really wanted to address before we home stretch this. Synchronicities. You talked about, okay, there was a setup, you know, that Fari mentioned, I'll drop you a line if it's true. And he said it almost jokingly. And it was literally a line that he dropped me. It was a change in a document using ink that was a message from him that was the first puzzle. And chemists got involved in studying that ink. And the more they got involved, the more baffled they became. And their studies went on for 3 years and became fruitless at being able to reproduce what happened to me. But synchronicities that the skeptics often just dismiss as mere coincidence. Well, I don't think that they're always mere coincidence at all. I think they have meaning. When these highly improbable things happen that are like a precursor and do have a sense of prescience for what's going to happen in the future. It happened to me in two ways in this project. First, I'll say, when I was a boy growing up in Maryland and wanted to be a filmmaker, I was reading Fari's Monster magazine and I was making amateur monster movies. I entered a contest in his magazine, and I was one of the winners in it. And I got publicity in his magazine.
Wow.
And he sent me a letter. I was 13 years old, if I remember correctly, to master movie maker Paul Davids. And I kept that letter always, and I kept the envelope. And the stamps on it were stamps of Santa Fe, New Mexico, the Palace of the Governors of Santa Fe, and Edgar Allan Poe. Now, I had never been like west of Virginia at that point in my life. I didn't know that I would grow up to live on the West Coast and that Santa Fe would be very important to me eventually and that I would own a home there one day. I didn't know when I was a boy getting this envelope that this incident involving Fari and afterlife would happen in my second home in Santa Fe and that the day after the ink incident happened, a very perplexing electronic voice phenomena would be captured on videotape involving Edgar Allan Poe. So the two stamps I received on the congratulatory envelope when I was 13, Poe and Santa Fe, came together in reality for me decades later when there was something paranormal involving Poe that happened to me in my house in Santa Fe. At the time that Fari Ackerman was communicating with me with an ink message. So,
right.
You know, for the skeptics, they say, what are you proposing? Time travel? You know, how?
Exactly. But see, that's, I think, where we're kind of caught up in this skeptical, reductionistic, materialistic, you know, versus the paranormal explanation. And what I'm suggesting is, we kind of have to move past that and look. And we're look for the next level. But we can't do that if we keep
holding on to the rational mind.
And we can't do that if we keep holding on to the rational mind's need to take the paranormal and jam it back into a box. I mentioned a minute ago, Dean Radin's the first person to do, or one of the first people, the researchers to do the presentiment experiment. Are you familiar with those experiments?
I'm familiar with Dean Radin. Which experiments are you talking about?
This is an experiment he's done, been replicated many times, many different labs across the world, and there's other versions of this experiment, but here's the simplest one. This is an experiment done for years with college psychology freshmen. Sit you down in front of the computer. I'm going to show you an image. An image is going to pop up. It might be pornographic. It might be really violent, or it might be puppies on a green lawn. And then I'm going to measure through some means, various different means, your biological skin response or the dilation of your pupil or whatever, right? So that's what I'm going to do.
EEG and electroencephalograph.
Yeah, and they've done all the different ones. So his twist on the experiment is to say, okay, we know that how long it takes you to react to the image and this and that. Do you react to the image before it's displayed on the screen? Do you react to the image before it is even selected by the computer? The answer is yes. Now we take it over into the medium realm, you know, the assisted after-death communication, which we all call mediumship, and we hear that people can predict what's going to happen in someone's life. Key events happens over and over again. We move into the after-death communication that comes as part of the near-death experience. And near-death is a misnomer because many of these people do, in fact, die clinically. And what do they say? They say, my life was planned out. I reviewed my life and I reviewed future events in my life. This is said all the time. I remember between lives when I was planning my life. So all these things give an entirely different perspective on all the things that you're talking about, right? So now we have to look at the stamps a little bit differently. We have to look at the message that Forey gave you beforehand, you know, I'll drop you a line. We have to look at it a little bit differently. And when we do it, we can do it with some of the tools of science, but we are going to have to leave. We're going to have to so totally turn that upside down that I don't think we can. I think we have to be realistic about where we can go and what it's going to take to get us there. And I think I'm with you that we have to have a more open environment, but then that gets into a whole deeper political realm of, does that really make the trains run on time kind of thing?
Alex, you know, I'm reminded of, I always sort of like to tell the parable about Moses and the promised land, and he spent 40 years going across the desert with the tribes of Israel to settle them in the promised land, he wanted a generation to die off and a new generation to settle there, a generation who hadn't been slaves. And I think that a lot of the changes in worldview that happen in all of human society happen through the death of one generation and being replaced by another, more than people changing their minds. You know, people die and they're replaced by somebody who has a different worldview because the information available, you know, has increased and has changed. It's a kind of a dark way of looking at it, but it's a fact.
But it presupposes this kind of time factor, again, that I just don't think when we really pull apart consciousness and our best science, it's just not there. When we talk about past, future, next lives, it's not what we think. And this is what the mystics have told us all along. And that's what pushes us back. You know, you didn't want to go too far into the love thing, but that what's pushes us back is to all there is the now, you know, the now and what we do right now. And we should be very humble about really any kind of contribution we make or about something that someone's going to do in the future. Just make sure you're taking care of business at home, which means inside yourself and with the people that you interact with and that you're doing the right thing there, and everything takes care of itself.
Yeah, it's a good philosophy. I think it works. I try to subscribe to that. And to never lose the sense of amazement and surprise, because the universe is always revealing a little more of itself to us, you know, as time goes on. So the things we thought were impossible when we were young become fact, you know, when we're older. And for me, part of this transition makes me much more open-minded to religious people than I was when I was a kid growing up with agnostic parents who felt that, you know, prayer was for the weak and that there was no foundation in any of the claimed biblical miracles. And I don't feel that now. I feel like any of those biblical miracles could be true now in the universe that I live in. I can't reject. It doesn't mean that they are true. It doesn't mean that they're not myths. But I have a new mindset where I could say, well, you know, they could be. You know, that could have happened.
At the very least, we have to grant the religious that in the big picture, science versus religion, they're scoring more points as we march forward and understand consciousness. The points are piling up on their side. They might not have a lot of things wrong in terms of their books and their myths and stuff like that, but big picture, they got it right.
The rigidity, I think, is wrong. The rigidity of religious structure, I'll never subscribe to. You know, the rule following, and you know, if you know all the things that go with it, being raised with the fear of sinning, and you know, hell and damnation, and all those things. Now, none of that is ever going to hold any weight for me. But the concept of a miracle, it's intervention from somewhere else, into our world, and praying for a miracle, you know, is it possible that you could have the result that you pray? Yeah, could be. I'm open to all of it now.
Yeah.
You know, so
Paul, where do you go from here with the book, both with the book and Atheist in Heaven? And I'm sure I actually noticed on IMDb that you have some more film projects. I'm not surprised.
Yes.
In the works.
Yes.
They might not be related to this, but are you done publicly with after-death communication in terms of books and films, or will that find its way into your work in the future, or what do you think?
Well, it's always a process of discovery for me, because I never quite know what's going to, you know, come next. I made a film with a Latino cast called Before We Say Goodbye, which has a life-after-death theme. And it's very undiscovered in the U.S. I'm really surprised by that. In Latin America, it's been a huge success. Universal picked it up. They dubbed it into Spanish and Portuguese. And it's shown on all the cable channels for years now, a few years in Latin America. In the U.S., it showed in Spanish on Telemundo once. It's recently been added to Amazon Prime. It's a wonderful, hopeful story with a kind of a Catholic orientation toward it, because it's about Catholics. It's about Hispanic Americans and devout belief in Our Lady of Guadalupe and all the miracles connected with that. And it's not a documentary. It's a story film. So I recommend to people to watch that. It's on Amazon Prime. And if you're a Prime member, you see it for free. And then there's a wonderful DVD. So that dealt with the life after death theme and prayer and miracles. My film, The Artist and the Shaman, also dealt with life after death and the question of reincarnation. My film Starry Night, about Vincent van Gogh, it was a fantasy, yes, but the fantasy was, what if Vincent van Gogh could come back today for 100 days and discover that he was a success after all? And I played with that story. So again, it's the concept of someone returning from the dead. It embeds itself into a lot of these projects I've done. Now, my upcoming film that will be out this year, it'll be a Blu-ray, a DVD, it'll go on television, is called Marilyn Monroe Declassified. And it's a fascinating look at the mysteries around Marilyn Monroe's life and her death, and the attention she attracted to herself from the FBI and the CIA, and where that led. For me, that was a mystery story. The life after death aspect there, well, in An Atheist in Heaven, in the book we've been talking about, there's a chapter where I talk about the strange anomalies that happened related to Marilyn Monroe while I was making that movie. As if I was, you know, as if there was a helping hand there. It's an unsolved death, and I've worked on solving it. It, in my view, was not probable suicide, which is what the coroner said. I do think that the wonderful lady was murdered, and I do think I've really gotten to the bottom of it. So, and I think I was helped in making Marilyn Monroe Declassified. So there's that too. And as far as where it goes from here, Alex, I'd like your listeners to know I'm a very serious painter. I'm an artist. Paul David's -artist.com. You can see my work. The Rio Grande Gallery in Albuquerque has just picked up four of my paintings. Very old, distinguished gallery. I'm in good company there. Gallery Tesla in Sedona has some of my work. So I think there'll be much more time spent in building that legacy also as a painter, in addition to the writing I've done. One last thing on the writing. I won't call it a memoir exactly, but I do feel I have begun to write about this extraordinary storied life I've been able to live in Hollywood, getting to work on lots of projects, starting with the Transformers cartoons and working on the Star Wars books and all of these movies. So I am writing a retrospective to preserve the wonderful adventures that were in all of that and share them. And that's something I'd like to finish. It's on my bucket list.
Well, best of luck with all that. And I think you've done a real terrific work, you and Gary have, with An Atheist in Heaven and with the other films we talked about. So certainly wish you the best. And thanks again so much for coming on Skeptico, Paul.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a real pleasure. We covered a lot of ground, and I'm very happy about that.
And I was going to bring this up, but we kind of spent enough time on the skeptics, you know.
Yeah.
But here's the skeptical thing. And I like, when I was researching the show, I went to Skeptic Magazine, you know, and I read, this is a great post from a skeptic, Michael Shermer's magazine, Skeptic Magazine, and he's really dissing Schwartz's research. And he said, yeah. I'll read you this, and I might even throw this back into the show. But he goes, here's the poster from Skeptics Magazine, Michael Shermer's website, with regard to Gary Schwartz's research. The whole study is rubbish. How does he know that ghosts are inside the boxes? These are the boxes that are inside Gary Schwartz's photon gatherer that he uses to measure this. In the boxes could have been unicorns, dragons, or even God himself. In a strange, twisted way, this person's right in that we don't know. We hypothesize that it's Ackerman, and that Ackerman has some limits to how he can communicate and how he can interact with us. And all these things become assumptions.
I wish you could hear what happened to your voice as you were speaking to me. It was like, you can't imagine how the sound became distorted. Well, all right, so maybe somebody's playing with us right now here at the end of the show. But yeah, okay, so it could be dragons and unicorns disguised as Forrest J. Ackerman or photons of light.
Thanks again to Paul Davids for joining me today on Skeptico. The one question I tee up from this interview is the same question I'd ask Paul. What would you like to see science, however you define science, do to improve our understanding of after-death communication? So let me know your thoughts through the Skeptico website, on the forum, Facebook, email, however you like to do it. I just think it's kind of cool. I always throw out that question because I like connecting with people listening to the show and hearing what they have to say. And I like throwing out these questions. And so we have somewhat of a common central point to kind of focus on. Remember, by the way, you know, if you've listened to this podcast out of sequence, which I do all the time, I listen to a ton of podcasts, but I'll be listening to something from 3 or 4 months ago and I'll go, oh, wow, I have a question. I wish I could talk to somebody about that. Hey, feel free to do that. You know, join the forum, post it. People do a really good job of staying up on stuff, even if it's been a few months ago. And I try to do as well. So don't feel just because a show is a little bit older, you can't connect with somebody about it. That's the fun thing about podcasting. So I have a number of interesting shows coming up, more shows this summer, some other projects I'm working on. Do stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.